Hello and welcome to Databook. I am Jack Murtha.
And I'm Tom Castles. We're coming at you live from the Expo.Health conference in Boston, Massachusetts today. If you haven't heard of it, definitely check it out. And boy, do we have a great episode for you today.
But Tom, what is so great about this particular episode of Databook?
You know, Jack, that's a great question, and I have a simple answer for you. It's our guest, Dr. Eric Topol. He's the author of the book Deep Medicine about AI and healthcare, and he's one of the most respected cardiologists, researchers, and physician executives in all of medicine, really. Today, we're telling the story of the rise of AI, and of course, its limitations, too, through his eyes, his experiences, and his insights.
Before we get to that, if you like Databook, please head on over and rate, subscribe, review, and tell a friend.
Seriously, if you haven't rate, subscribed, and reviewed, what are you waiting for? And remember, of course, that this is an Inside Digital Health podcast. You can find us online at idigitalhealth.com. We're also on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. So go ahead and connect with us there too.
Now, on with the show.
When Eric Topol was a teenager, he was diagnosed with a rare condition. It's called osteochondritis desiccans. Yeah, that was probably tough for any kid to pronounce, but it was even tougher to live with.
The condition basically wrecked Eric's knees. He was in a lot of pain, and it was not a good situation. It was frustrating, especially considering his age, right? What teen wants to deal with the limitations born of two bad knees?
The cause of the condition was not well known, but doctors did have a way to treat it. Here's Eric Topol.
I had extensive surgery back in when I was a teenager, just before starting med school. And that led to a lot of bone being taken out. And I was told that by the time I was 40, I'd have to have a knee replacement.
But that didn't happen right away. Eric kept going with his sawed bones and kind of sort of repaired knees and began building a better career for himself. He became a hugely respected cardiologist, geneticist, and digital medicine investigator. You probably heard a bit about his accomplishments, but here are a few.
So he played a huge role in elevating the Cleveland Clinic's cardiology program, which is top tier. And he also founded the Lerner College of Medicine over there at Cleveland Clinic. He published more than 1,000 peer-reviewed papers. He led pioneering clinical trials with hundreds of thousands of patients. And he identified genes associated with heart problems.
He wrote books. He sat on health tech startup boards where he helped carve a path to our idea of digital health today. He developed drugs. He founded the Scripps Research Translation Institute. He even won a $207 million grant from the NIH to run a major precision medicine study.
So you get it, right? But those were just the headlines. That was the stuff that the public got to know and that we probably benefited from in some way or another. But during all this time, and that would be about 40 years of Eric Topol's life, there was another story, a hidden story, that was dominating everything behind the scenes.
Eric Topol was still in pain. In fact, his knees were getting worse. Over time, he had to cut out some of the finer things in life, you know, hiking, tennis, any intense activity like that. He was receiving treatment, but it didn't really seem to make a difference.
Ultimately, I just couldn't really walk.
And at age 62, Eric was finally about to undergo a total knee replacement surgery.
I was told by the orthopedist, you know, I would do well. I was, you know, pretty thin and fit and relatively young. So I went and had the surgery. The surgery itself went fine, but then I had a horrific post-op course.
This week on Databook, the story of Dr. Eric Topol. From his agonizing recovery that probably could have been avoided, perhaps with the right algorithm, to the ways that artificial intelligence can and cannot help patients and healthcare at large.
Just a couple of days after surgery, Eric Topol began his physical therapy regimen. It was the routine therapeutic protocol. That involved some pretty intense bending and extension. It was pretty hard. It was grueling, but it was supposed to prevent scarring in the joint.
And this is where things began to go very, very wrong for Eric. All of a sudden, his knee became profoundly swollen.
It was blue, looked like it was affected by gangrene. And I had very little mobility. I couldn't sleep. I was just in really bad mental shape, crying spells, and just trying desperately to get better and getting some mobility, but having a really hard time.
About a month after the surgery, Eric and his wife returned to the orthopedist to try to get to the bottom of all of this. I mean, how could everything be going so horribly, painfully wrong? He spilled it all out to the doctor, everything that's been broken, and then this happened.
The orthopedist said, well, you need to see your internist and get a prescription for antidepressants.
Wow.
Wow, indeed. It was the frequent crying and the lack of sleep. That is what nudged the doctor to suggest that Eric was depressed. Never mind the near constant pain, forget his inability to bend his knee.
With that bad advice, he went on to try a bunch of stuff that, as a doctor, he knew probably wouldn't work. But as a patient, with his options running out, he figured, why not? We're talking about acupuncture, electrical stimulation device, and even the keto diet. Nothing worked. Eric and his wife also kept digging through the literature, searching for answers. Eventually, they came upon one: arthrofibrosis.
It was this rare condition that caused intense scarring in maybe 2 or 3% of patients who had undergone a knee replacement surgery. So Eric took this revelation to his doctor, and his doctor said pretty much, yeah, obviously that's what you have. But he said there was nothing that he could do. They would need to wait a whole year for the inflammation to mellow out before the orthopedist could even consider removing the scar tissue.
And that was unacceptable. Here was Eric, by all means a giant of modern medicine, and he could barely walk. Eventually, he came upon a different physical therapist who took a drastically different approach. It wasn't about aggressive lifting or bending or whatever. She was gentle and big on anti-inflammatory medications. She wrote down instructions for Eric to follow.
And very quickly, when that was initiated, things started to turn around. I've never healed, to normal, but I got much better to the point I wasn't in so much pain, and I got, a fair amount of mobility back eventually. And the other thing about her was very different. She would examine my knee very carefully at each exam, each session that I went to her. And she texted me almost every day, how is our knee doing? Whereas I never even heard from my orthopedist.
In the end, the solution to all of Eric's problems was kind of simple. He just needed to follow a different path. If only his orthopedist had known.
So for even more on that story, you really gotta check out Eric Topol's new book. Seriously. It's called Deep Medicine, and it is a must-read. That is, if you're interested in the future of AI for healthcare and what it could all mean for patients, physicians, and health systems.
And we're going to give you some of those insights right here, right now. We didn't tell Eric's story just because it was interesting or scary or frustrating. His story was important, too. It hit these bigger notes: empathy, disconnected health data, and the potential of AI. Here is Eric.
It's a personal account of shallow medicine, not having the information at hand, not having the patients all their record teed up so that they would have the best possible outcome, and why we need to get better.
First, let's look back at how Eric got into this mess. The problem was not the surgery itself, but the follow-up physical therapy. Let's follow protocol and put Eric through some really intense workouts like we do for everyone. But if the doctor better understood Eric's medical condition, and maybe if the doctor had greater access to Eric's health data, it might have become crystal clear that business as usual just wasn't the way to go. Eric's second physical therapist had worked with plenty of patients who had suffered from the same rare condition. She knew that it was all about being gentle, that in this case, less was more.
Maybe it's unreasonable to expect every orthopedist to know how to approach every rare condition, but it is perfectly reasonable to expect something close to that from, say, a computer, an algorithm, from AI. And yes, Eric believes that it could have saved him a whole lot of trouble.
Well, in the case of my knee replacement, AI would have helped with respect to having all my prior history in an alert mode for the planning of post-op care, and also disseminating the wisdom of the physical therapist who I eventually did see about the type of customized program.
The point is, there's a ton of patient data out there. And sure, it's disjointed and ignored, and in some cases, just plain old incorrect. But if a health system had that data available, an AI system could make sure that it reaches the clinician. That is one reason why we need to achieve interoperability. But the pure amount of data, tucked away in medical records, scans, labs, and even sensors, it also makes this an incredibly hard task.
The amount of data is exploding, and we have no mechanism at the moment for pulling that together. No human being can do it. That's why we need to lean on machines and AI algorithms.
Tom, let's face it. Healthcare needs to start adopting AI. But when we're talking about health systems getting on board with this, we're not talking about just any old algorithm. We need validated software, the stuff that helps patients and helps physicians. Software that has been shown to work. Health systems need to cut through the noise and embrace the solutions that are, quite simply, real.
And if you ask Eric, health systems also need to make the right choices on the implementation side of things. He points to AI systems for radiology, the kind of software that can analyze scans for potential health issues. If the goal is to improve accuracy, but a hospital adopts the tech with the goal of jacking up the number of scans read per day, that might cause a whole new set of challenges.
These algorithms need to be under surveillance because if there's a glitch, they always require human oversight. You don't want to make a life or death decision or critical matter without having a radiologist or any clinician expert overseeing it. So these are important matters to keep in mind is on the one hand, try to get this moving, and on the other is keep it under careful watch.
So here's a question. Let's just say that a health system does adopt an AI system, like one for radiology. But then it does not raise the number of scans that a doctor needs to read in a single day. Then what? Sure, the results are more accurate, and I don't want to sound ungrateful here, but is that all?
Not if you follow Eric's school of thought. Improved accuracy and efficiency are both baked into the design, but it goes a step deeper. You see, deep medicine isn't really just about deep learning or AI. It's this idea that technology can actually inject more humanity and more empathy into care.
So you asked Eric what he considered to be the five magic characteristics of a physician. And what did he say?
He said care, 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 care. And I'll let you guess the fifth one on your own.
Bravado.
Close.
Care.
You got it.
All right. Well, look, exactly. Right? He's dead on. Because the truth is, insufficient technology and 1,000 other factors, like the number of patients a doctor must see, for example, all that stuff is getting in the way of care. And here's Eric.
Everyone talks about training machines, you know, for deep learning algorithms. I like to train administrators. I like to train the C-suite managers. Well, what is the most important thing here? Let's turn inward and let's do everything we can to rebuild the patient-doctor relationship, bring back the care, enhance the humane, the humanistic aspects of medicine.
So he points to an example, Geisinger Health System. Over there, administrators launched a program where certain patients were required to receive no less than 40 minutes with their doctors. 40 whole minutes per appointment. The doctors weren't even allowed to leave the room before the clock ran out.
And Eric actually said that the results were good. Happy patients, happy physicians, and promising outcomes.
If we do that, the health systems that do that are going to start to see patient satisfaction jump up. You're going to start to see burnout dissipating.
That kind of genuine care, you know, that empathy, is what really struck Eric when he was in the throes of unimaginable pain. So do you remember how the physical therapist would text Eric? She would ask him how our knee, not his knee, was doing.
And there's another clear way for health systems to use AI to make the doctor-patient relationship even stronger. And that's through voice. I'm talking about smart speakers. You know, basically Alexa for healthcare. Eric argues that the keyboard is the common enemy of the physician and the patient. That might be true. It's certainly a major barrier between them.
I think if you care about somebody, then you have presence. That is, presence meaning that you're really there. You're giving undivided attention. You're just there with the patient and for the patient. And that's why we went into healthcare. But the care has been lost. It's been seriously eroded and degraded over decades.
And algorithms might just be the catalyst for a new kind of medicine, but they can't do everything. So give me 2 seconds of your time, and we're going to get you to a story told by Dr. Eric Topol himself, in his own words, about a case where AI could never have worked. It just won't apply to this situation. Now, I promise you 2 seconds. So, one, please go ahead and rate, subscribe, and review this podcast, Databook. It'll really help. 2, check us out on iDigitalHealth.com. This is an Inside Digital Health podcast, and all of our Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn stuff.
And now, here's Eric Topol.
So, I had a patient in their 70s, and he had a very rare condition known as idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, known as IPF, for which there are some new therapies, but they have very mixed results and lots of side effects. But his lung function, although very compromised, was quite stable. And he presented whereby he was having profound fatigue and unable to do the minimal exercise he was capable of doing. He showed up in my clinic with his wife, and he looked like an entirely different fellow who I'd known for some years. He could barely walk without getting short of breath, and he looked really haggard and pale and sick. You know, he'd had peripheral artery disease and a stent put in one of his leg arteries. And so it came to mind, since his lung doctor had cleared that this was not the lungs at this point, and it was not high blood pressure in the pulmonary circuit, then what else could it be? And I decided that we ought to take a look, if he was interested and willing, at his arteries of his heart, since they had never previously been diseased or implicated. So we did a coronary CT angiogram, which is a non-invasive test that gives a map of the 3 coronary arteries. And it showed, interestingly, a very tight narrowing in the right coronary, a large right coronary, but also tight narrowing. And he didn't have angina or tightness in his chest, but he did have this shortness of breath. So the peculiar part of this was that the right coronary artery is not normally associated with shortness of breath. That would be remarkably rare, if not almost unheard of, in my times as a cardiologist over the years. Because the right coronary artery doesn't provide a blood supply to enough heart muscle, and his left coronary artery, the 2 major branches of that, were fine. But I discussed it with him, and I said, do you want to try having a stent put in, because that would alleviate the narrowing, but we don't know whether that's going to improve the symptom. And he and his wife discussed it, and he was really kind of at the end of the rope and pretty desperate. And he said, I want to try the stent. And I was a bit surprised, of course, because he was one that was quite averse to procedures throughout the years. He didn't even want to have the stent put in his leg artery when he was having a hard time walking because of lack of blood supply to his leg and claudication. At any rate, he had the stent. He had a remarkable positive recovery and was able to get back to his baseline. In fact, perhaps even better than his baseline. So that story is noteworthy because an algorithm would not have predicted a clinical response like he had. These help to emphasize the human element and the importance of a person knowing their body and shared decision-making and all the sort of things that are the human bond to help guide in a situation like this.
Before we go, I just want to give a shout out to our intern this past summer, Jack Coleman. Jack, you've done a great job. That's going to do it for this episode. I'm Jack Murtha.
And I'm Tom Cassis.
And this is Databook.